to advertise, email podcast@thisisvechi.com.
Release yourself from order and logic and enter a new place. It's not work. It's not home. Here, no maps have been drawn. No books have been written. Nothing is certain. Everything is possible. Welcome to podcast and chill with Matt G.
I'm assuming this doesn't end well.
So, I know that politics is very, very serious. So before we even go into and delve into politics, let's start on a bit of lighter stuff. What would you say is better? Missing a call from your wife, number one, traversing Johannesburg potholes?
The worst call is missing my wife. I have a wife who loves being loved.
Okay.
Loves attention. And I love that about her. You miss a call from her, there's hell coming after that.
So you'd rather deal with potholes and council meetings than missing her call?
I'd prefer to have a happy home. I can deal with a car anytime. I cannot deal with an upset wife.
Happy wife, happy home, right?
Yeah.
All right. Go maybe to the beginning and speak about Attridgeville. When you were growing up in Attridgeville, the dusty streets of Attridgeville, Liberty Bra.
Yes.
What did politics look like to you?
So I come from a home where there were politics. You know, my uncle was one of the war veterans, if you like, or somebody who had actually then been in the struggle. And so I grew understanding, knowing politics. But I think my mom always tried to shield me from mainstream politics. My mom always, you know, dreamt of me, and my grandmother as well saw me as a doctor. In fact, my grandmother saw me as a pastor or a bishop in a church or a reverend, because my grandfather was a reverend. So I think that is where they actually then saw me. So they was always trying to shield me from that, but I was aware of the politics around. I went to Sawridge High, stayed in an informal settlement that at the time where, you know, there was this push, and then there was a portion of Attridgeville called Jeffsville that was established, that was being established. Now, if you know who Jeff Masemola is, Jeff Masemola was one of the people that served in Robben Island, yes, one of the struggle icons. And, you know, that time when we started hearing Jeffsville and the push against, you know, denying people access, you know, to land and all of that. I think that's when I started becoming aware of what was happening around us and then the politics thereof. And, you know, one became conscious, but I think also because of the shielding that I was getting from my parents, there was always that pushback to then say, concentrate on your books, concentrate on going to school. I mean, I was a debater of note at school, singer of note at school.
Oh,
not me. I was in the boys choir. I was in the mixed choir. I was the leader in our debating team. Did play basketball. When it was introduced, we played cricket there. So that is what my folks wanted me to focus on, and not, you know, politics per se. And I think it hit much later on, I mean, in university, maybe when I started, and then there was SRCs and all of that. That's when one sort of got a taste, but never really got too involved into it until later on, when I then got involved into mainstream politics.
You know, when we grow up, Hunalma Khotmane Kokasi, that Rabatsbez Makeda, understand? Yeah. And then, you know, Gana Kosabo Sasko, Zabo Paso, Zabo Ing. And being young at that time, it's things that are just happening, Kokasi.
Yeah.
Not realizing there's a revolution brewing. Because I think at the time and at your age, that was almost when Mandela was about to be released. Yeah. There were a lot of riots, tear gas every other second day, Kokasi.
Yeah.
That thing of Bo Albani could not come into Kasi, Bo Sasko could not come into Kasi. Were you seeing those things, and what did they then mean to you as you were seeing them as a young child? Because,
yeah,
I mean, I experienced it, but Hun Night was just that thing, this is political unrest, this is what we know.
So You know, I remember we were staying at that time, and I'll tell you a story that really told, you know, really spoke to exactly what you're asking. Mm-hmm. So I remember three houses from my house, from my grandma's house, there used to be three brothers, Posha, Opa, Ntakane. Mm-hmm. And they were the dust raisers in the area. Mm-hmm. And I remember there was a time when Attridgeville, they had switched off electricity around. I mean, we were fortunate to have electricity from, as far as I could remember, we had electricity.
Yes.
But there was a time that it was switched off. And because we stayed literally two blocks away from the police station, and we could see next to the, what we, then it was called the Super Stadium, now it, later it was called Muripe.
Lucas Muripe Stadium. Yeah.
So I literally stayed behind that, yes. Right? So I remember there was a substation there that had been switched off. And these guys went there and switched it on. And then a pole next to our house had tripped. Mm-hmm. And I remember Posha climbing that whole pole. And as he got to the top, as he was about to switch on, a police vehicle, drove into our street and was speeding. Yes. I jumped out from Kodima, jumped into the fence tree and into our yard. And he was allowed to go into our house and hit there. And I was like, but why? What is this? And why is it happening? And later on, when I hear, after the van had left, and that's what would have happened, this would have happened. And then you sort of get that sense that there's something here that is not right. Brilliant. So and I remember when, you know, when Mandela, the morning that Mandela was actually released, there was a song that they were singing going to the stadium, going to Super Stadium at that time. 5 o'clock, Molexe, Sokululu, Mandela, Sokululu. And then we were there as youngsters, and we were just singing. And then, you know, you're just going there, and you're Sokululu, Mandela. And as a youngster, you're just going and you're singing. And then all of a sudden, we are told, no, you're not going to school. You know, and then you then start realizing and start being taught. As my uncle then, you know, came back home and was very passionate about telling us the stories, you know, about why, what was happening, what's happening, and all of
this
that.
This is the time when he's coming back from exile.
When he got back into the country, because they came around the same time, yeah. Right? So then, I mean, this is somebody that you know, but you didn't really know.
Yes.
You know, and
is that
and
uncle
now,
like it happened also during yes. that time? You couldn't really speak about them because my brother left for exile, and then in LPAC,
yes.
Right? He left for exile, and we could never ever talk about it because we didn't know who was listening. We didn't know who was a spy. I can tell your story, Soli, that there's a gentleman at that time. I can't remember Khotman Lek, about time Alebi Kima, just after my brother had left. He started befriending my dad. And yes. He started befriending my dad.
Yeah.
And he'd come often, go hi, and then it'd be a little time a little that visits my dad and comes and drinks with my dad, whatever. Ramuva out of Sibuking at the time, because Rilda's booking, Ratwa's booking Radudula into a suburb called Beroth Park, one of the first darkies to go live in that place. Anyway, cut a long story short, Khotman Lakala Khuta from exile. Right, comes back from exile. We're all excited. We're all very happy because for 5 years we didn't know where he was.
Yeah.
We didn't know where he was alive, whether he was dead. Nobody knew anything, and we never spoke about it. That after the day he left, maybe for the first month or so, hey, Abdim Rapedi. Then after that, we kept quiet because we, as I said, don't know what's about Manki Askali, Manki Ing at the time, and we were just told as children that don't speak about him because you know they'll burn your house, whatever. Yeah. You know how our parents try and shield you as you're saying. Fast forward to when my brother comes back from exile, as you're speaking about that story. Bramzi, that's what's his name. Bramzi comes home, right? And my brother opens the door, and obviously because my brother's back, I'm excited. I get so I'm like his, you know, like wherever he is, I'm right there. You know, wherever he moves, I'm right there. My brother opens the door and I see him. Wabo, I'm like, how? You know, and he turns around and he leaves. And Kapu says, hey, Tatem Zilika, no, daddy, hi, or whatever, Bramzi leaves. I then asked my brother Ramfit, Damzini, this is the guy that was assigned to come and kill me.
Wow.
At the time before I left. So he didn't befriend my father.
Yes.
Out of loving my dad. He was actually sent to come and check when is he back or try and get information from my dad or whatever, whatever. And you know what I mean? That's why, because I mean, obviously, he says to me, he was for like 2 weeks.
Yeah.
And he'd see us in town, he'd see us wherever, but that was the time they were still organizing his things. He started in Lesotho, from Lesotho, then ended up, in Tanzania.
Yes.
And that was his story. You know what I mean? So, as you're saying, and that what you're telling me reminds me of that story, to say that, you know, the stories of those people when they came back, I mean, I was blown away by what my brother experienced. You know what I mean? Listening to your uncle after he arrived, do you think that's when maybe the spark also hit to say that there's something much bigger here and I want to be a part of it?
So I think at the time when they came out, or when they came, there was the excitement about the possibility. That is before the elections, by the way.
Yes. And at that time, it was still volatile.
Yes. And I think what it really became a little bit rowdy, but it was not that bad. We were fortunate that as much as there were issues in hostels, we didn't feel it as much as you would have had go Sharpeville and other, you know, Wipatong and all of that. We never really felt that impact. But there was always this talk about zizo, you know, there's something that is coming. My uncle was excited, was one of those who's thinking, now we're going to enjoy. I mean, you guys are gonna be able to then go to Kulosama Hoa, you know, you'll be able. Look, I will never say that I was one of the smartest, but you know, my family always affirmed us and affirmed Runaba Nerkena School. No. You'll be one of the best. And I remember that time, then they started allowing or opening the former Model C schools. And you could see some of the people that I grew up with then. Because the parents could afford, then they were going, you know, into your former Model C's. I remember having a friend, Mukona, and she was the first to go in our area, Loreto. Yeah. You know, they were going to Loreto, Monaga Plaza, right in the morning, you know.
Yes.
I don't know, Melapa, Sekakwale,
and then the next day.
Yeah. You know? So, you would then see that, and Obanabun Tabi saying it, going to Bolodiamu and all of that. And Runa still going to Kasi because, unfortunately, you know, my family was not well off. But, you know, not complaining about that. But I think that's when you started seeing that change. And I think it brought a lot of excitement. And there was a lot of hope that, you know, things are actually then going to improve and are going to improve for the better for a lot of people. But I must also say that as a young person who grew up not knowing any different, we knew that Rea Toropong, Mansendi,
Ramahui,
you know, Rea Toropong, Alfikara, I remember there used to be a place that my grandmother used to love and taking us. Indian delight. So we eat Indian food that day. It was delicacy, you know. You'd go lokono plomanyana go tramshetada balrigeti ice cream yana mole and all of that, and then kamutexing a grocery, you go home.
Yes.
I mean, there was nothing different. The only other time that I saw a bit of difference, but luckily, the people that allowed us that space, white people, that the Schneiders, there's a family called the Schneiders. My uncle's wife worked for them for generations.
Okay.
Now I'm saying generations because worked for the grandfather, worked for the father and the son.
Yes.
So those three generations,
yes.
You know, and. Auntie Mopi was part of that family for generations,
yes.
For years. So we could visit. They would allow me to play in the pool, play with the grandchild. It was okay. It was normal. But I could see the difference that
of course.
How local location I own a swimming pool. There's only a communal swimming pool somewhere. Yes. You know, or lo dlala kwa kukumetsing ka kwa ku mrao kwa kwa and ulo shapiwa ke aba ka le bona le lokolo shapiwa because if you drown what happens, you know?
Who's going to come fetch you, right?
Yeah, yeah. And then there's the other side where there's a pool in the yard, there's nice food, you know, there's nice food, but at the time you know, you were just happy that during that time auntie could take us there and, you know, there'll be clothes. Coming from a poor background, when Baufiledi secondhand clothes, you were very appreciative of those because you didn't know better, right? But I think when things started changing, you then start seeing, then, you know, people who are then start pushing. I remember getting into matric. Even before matric, then we were taken on a program, a science program. We used to belong to a program that called the ProTech program. So they will take kids from the township, and then they will take us to go and do extra lessons in science and maths.
Yes, yes.
So we were part of that. Myself, Temba, Moso, Isaac, Brian, a group of our guys there, we were selected and we were doing that. So it became that. And then we became part of an exchange program. So we could then be taken to St. Albans School from time to time.
Okay.
You know, so then that's when it started hitting to then say, hang on, I sit and look at a teacher telling me what a computer does. I get to this place, I get to sit in front of a computer and do it.
Wow.
And that's when it hit me that there is a difference here. You know, from a teacher telling you what a computer does, a teacher standing in front in a lab, in a laboratory that didn't even have much, to a space where you could walk in. In Banabako school and saying that the books are just lying everywhere, that the backpacks are just lying everywhere, they're playing rugby kakwale, they're playing tennis kakwale. You'll never do that. That's as great as school beggars are mole. You'll never find anything there. Yeah. So I mean that's when you start realizing, okay, there's something of a difference here, right? So that is for me where I think that awakening really started hitting. And I remember asking, Ma, why can't I go to the school? It's nice. And I remember seeing a tear in my mom and saying, if your father was still alive, maybe you would be going there.
Would you then say politics found you, or you veered to politics because of moments like that?
I think for me, the real aha moment, look, I mean, I've never hidden this. In the first two elections, I voted for the ANC. The third time, I started doubting.
Okay.
And when I started doubting, it was when I was really starting to, when I was working now, I had an opportunity to travel. I was working for embassies at the time. And it so happened that I was in Liberia for a visit. So we went to Liberia. There was a project that we were busy with, a PEPFAR project. We had gone to Liberia to do some due diligence to then see, you know, if something was going to be funded, right? So we're there doing some work, and then we went. I remember going. We were at Charles Taylor's compound.
Yes,
and we were talking. Charles Taylor was sitting there. Big man, and I mean, at that time, yeah, well, you knew it was volatile in Liberia, but then there was protection around him, and the compound was all of that. And then somebody walks in and said, Pape, they called him Pape, so because of the pidgin English, Pape, there's a bus that is broken, a school bus, a government bus. The man opens a drawer, takes out dollars, gives to the guy and says, go sort it out. It hit me that, is this how government is supposed to be run, that decisions can be made like that and out of a drawer next to a desk? That's how you run government. I said, no, that can't be. I came back home and I started seeing some things. That's when, you know, you started hearing of scandals, the Sarafina scandal and all of that. And all these things were coming up. Remember the scandal about buying a new jet for the president and all of that. So those were the things that were now beginning to then bubble up and come up. And I remember then Tony came to Attridgeville, was invited Bakhrut Manengwe.
Tony Leon
comes to Atteridgeville, invited by Autiengwe Barke and Dr. Lot Matibedi at the time. They were at Atteridgeville Community Hall. And then I said, no, man, Nikila Atteridgeville, kanako. I'd moved out because I was now working and all that. So I'd gone to Atteridgeville, kilo wana old lady. So I hear now this man is coming, is there. So I'm like, okay, let me go and listen. Mm-hmm. And I get there. Now I'm listening. And, you know, it's all funfair. It's confetti, it's balloons, and it's coming in and, you know, gives a speech. Because I could hear what he's saying, but... And I was like, this is exactly what has been burning me, that we now need to have accountability of government officials. We need to then make sure that money is spent towards serving the people and all of that. But the way the message was coming across, I said, you're missing a whole lot of people because you are being technical. You're being technical about what you're saying. You're talking to people as if everybody in this room has got a university degree or has... a comprehension of what a R1 billion means. And I said, that's not it. Because, you know, Runa batho ba bantsu, no, ke khosi ya rona motho, ya motshwanela jet e eo, masikata jet.
Yes.
But yet you're saying you're having lists and lists of people that are still waiting for houses. Lists and lists of people that are losing jobs because Ko Pretoria West, you started having console not closing down.
Yes.
You score not closing down. And that affected a lot of people that were working Kamo Atteridgeville. PNP started having issues. Now, you had two Pretoria metal pressers factories there. That's where they were making bullets and guns. And then it was beginning to then, you know,
wind down. Yes.
And I'm like, but this is what you need to be talking to people about. How... those decisions are affecting their daily life. Don't tell them about big numbers. Koko aregisa muntle, that is aregisa di banana or mafielo, cannot comprehend what R1 billion is and what it could do. But if you say, you know, Koko, we could have built the tlokolotsa how that you're taking care of another school or whatever the case is, let it be relatable to somebody.
Let the message resonate.
Yes.
Was that then the time that you wrote the letter? Yes. Tell me about this letter.
So I wrote the letter and said, you know, you have a great message, but you're going about it the wrong way. Mm-hmm. In a township, and I put it blankly, in a township, you're going to be talking to people that possibly, and that's the reality of the day at the time, that you still had a lot of, you know, illiteracy that was there.
Of course.
But also you had a lot of... people that were still excited about democracy or the prospects thereof, but not understanding how to hold government to account.
Yes.
It was just the issue, or no, we have government, doesn't matter. You know, let's just get on with it.
That notion and idea, it's almost like we allowed the rot to happen,
yes,
in a way, you know, because nirnali this attitude, rather hoje rona than hoje mankamla.
But it was also the issue, yeah, hore, there was still the honeymoon phase, right? Yes. So, you know, government could do no wrong, yes, at that time. Mm. So, and I wrote and said, you need to make the message relatable and it needs to resonate with the people,
yeah,
right? And then I didn't expect much of it. I went on by my way. I get an answer. And then they say, would like to...
So you said this via email, right, at the time?
No. I wrote it and I got to the office, I faxed it.
Oh, no, sounds under fax. So yes. I'm sure none of these guys know faxing. I might say faxing emails.
So I faxed this thing and yeah. I got the details from Dr. Lord Matibet.
Yes.
You know, and I faxed this thing. I didn't even expect an answer. Mm-hmm. And then I get an answer. And then they say, no, we would like to meet with you. I remember... Then I was asked, no, can you come to Brakpan? Mm-hmm. Because that time, Mokhauteng, the office, ne logo Brakpan.
Head office, ya pila di lele Brakpan.
No, I think they'd moved.
Yeah.
I think they had an office in Joburg CBD.
Okay.
But they also had an office called Brakpan where they had a warehouse as well, mm-hmm, where they were storing their posters and all of that.
Yes. Oh, okay.
You know, so then I was asked, no, can you come and meet us? And I'm like, okay, who's us? Anyway, I'll go. Then I get there, the CEO of the party is there. Mm. Ryan Kutsia. And Ryan looks at me and says, interesting ideas that you wrote about. What's your background? And explain who I am, what I do, and all of that. And he says, do you love your country? He says, yes, I do, very much. He says, what are you willing to do for your country? I said, I'm willing to do anything for my country, because at that time, I had just had my firstborn. Aboko was just born.
Yes.
And there's nothing that gives you purpose than seeing an image of you on earth and say, I live for this little thing. Mm. And if I cannot make it work for this little thing, I would have failed as a parent.
Yes.
And I think once you get into that stage, nothing really... You live and breathe and work and your purpose. Okay, this person says, so how much do you love your country? I said, I've got no any other. And if I were to do anything to make sure that my son later on inherits a better country, then this is it. He says, no, we'd like you to come and work for us.
Oh, just like that.
No, he says, no, we would like you to come and implement that. We'd like to, what you're saying, we need to do.
Come do it.
Come and do it.
I grew old.
Yes. So I was like, hey. And then they said, what do you do? And then I told them, where do you work? I told them, okay, how much do you earn? And I told them, I said, we can't afford that. And I said, okay. But they said, but no, if you're serious about doing what you say you're passionate about and want to do, consider it. I went home. I had a chat with my then wife, late wife, one day. I said, hey, sweetie, this is what is happening. And she said to me, you know, do what you need to do. But she was unhappy that, you know, there's a salary cut that is coming. And so I then started working. I mean, I then moved. I had to adjust because I was literally, from where I was working, I was literally 15 minutes from my workspace.
Okay.
Now I had to go into an office from Pretoria to Brakpan every day. So I had to drive 200 kilometers, 100 one way, 100 back.
Yes.
Every single day. And now you've taken a salary cut. Now your fuel consumption and requirements have now grown. But I started getting a sense of purpose because then I got there. I was then an administrator. So I was not in the mainstream politics. I was an administrator. I was a director in the DA. I'm responsible for what we call the lead program, which is basically marketing and communications. Mm. So,
but that's very interesting that the party was run almost as a business.
Yeah.
Because I picked up two things. You say that you met the CEO of the DA, and then you were like a director within the CA, you know, director of marketing. Yeah. How was that not surprising for you? Because I mean, obviously knowing politics, SG, then now you come into this place that called himself a political party, but it's not.
And you have a well-established office. And you have, I mean, I remember one of the meetings when I was inducted. There was Tony. Then, you know, we got to meet and all of that. Again, you know, on a one-on-one basis. And then there was Shelley Liu, who was a member of parliament at the time, but was also somebody who was responsible for corporate identity at DA. So there were already professional staff that were working there, making sure that, you know, things are done in a professional manner. You had a CEO of a party. You had a finance CFO of a party. You had a COO of a party. And you had a number of directors. Director that was responsible for communication. Director that was... Even events had its own directors.
Hey,
so Tony Nasa Sameki, you know, if I own an event... And that's something that at the time, I remember there was a gentleman called... Russell Crystal. Russell was a top events coordinator. And, you know, Tony was very particular. Coming in, the place needs to be set up. People need to, if 9 o'clock we start, 9 o'clock people must be there, seated, we start. So this is how, you know, things were done. And then, you know, we started this program. I remember being introduced, those years, 20 years plus ago, to people like Matikizela, Bonginkosi Matikizela, Bufanyana, Bu We met with Bukume at the time, Kume Ramlepo, Ghana Makashule, and you know, they were then, you know, coming as a student, part of the DASU student organization, and we were putting all this thing together, you know, Butsepo Mhlongo at the time, you know, a lot of guys that we were coming up with. And at the time, I was then doing this lead program, and I wrote the manual that I still have somewhere. The first one that I said, this is how you go and campaign. Kukasi.
What was in that manual?
So I had to do two things.
Yeah.
Understanding that there were people that you can't just write a long manual that becomes too boring. And if you're going to talk to people that possibly, you know, the level of literacy will be low, it needs to have pictures that explain exactly what you want to then do and all of that. So we started doing that, right? So in that manual was about when you get there, how do you introduce yourself, where you come from, and understanding that at the time, in certain areas, it was almost a taboo to have the DA in that area.
No-go areas.
Yeah. So how do you then go about it? So we had all of that. And when you come and knock onto somebody's yard that is a bit, is a bit hostile, how do you then deal with that? So we had all of these things in there. When you get there, what do you mean? Is that you're coming from there? You want to talk to the issues that are affecting them in the area and all of that. How do you then deal with that? So we started then developing that at the time. And then I then started going, I had to then go province to province to province to province, training what we call the champions at the time on how to then deal with it and train others in the province.
Train the trainer.
Yes.
Train the trainer.
So program. We started doing that. And I remember we were driving into rural, deep rural Eastern Cape areas, deep rural KZN areas, deep rural Limpopo, and you know, we were able to then train people.
And deep rural is also hard entrenched, ANC territory, right?
It was, and at that time as well, I remember we were in, I think it was in Limpopo, when you know, we were told, no, you can't come here because. And we didn't know that, right? These are things that I didn't know.
Yes.
And now you also have to then retract your steps and then say, okay, maybe I also now need to really immerse myself in finding out the dynamics of each and every area so that we are able to then incorporate it into the training and to the communications going forward. Mm-hmm. Then we started developing an issue about, you know, even if the leader has got to go to this area, what must they be on the lookout for?
Well, what's the etiquette? What's the social etiquette, right?
Yeah. So when you go there, you don't just go into a rural area without Wilo Dumeri, so Wilo Kokotapelo Kosi. You
know, it's just,
yes, it's just respect, and it shows mutual respect that you're respecting the traditions that in an area. And then you do that, you find that Bakona Bulel. You don't do that, the Kosi might allow you, but then the message that follows after that is that, no, these people don't respect us. And then that spreads throughout. And then, you know, whatever that you would have come to say there.
Wasted your time. So now, let's also go back one or two steps.
Yeah.
You're doing this. You're going to the DA. You are now campaigning for the DA.
Yeah. Yeah.
What are people at home saying? What are your fellows? What are your friends saying? What are your fellow sort of people that you went to school with saying? Because you voted twice for the ANC. You're a sellout in their eyes. Like, how are you dealing with that?
So, first of all, my uncle stopped talking to me.
Your uncle from exile? Yeah.
My uncle stopped talking to me. Like, really stopped talking to me, right?
Did that hurt?
It hurt. I mean, these are people that... they were my fathers, right?
Yeah.
But it had that at the time when you would even go to family gatherings, it was a little bit awkward. But cool kitchen, and you couldn't even wear that T-shirt.
Uh-huh.
I remember that time the T-shirt was yellow, so you wear that T-shirt with a little bit of blue here. Hey, it was an issue.
Yeah.
But you know, I was very resolute at the time to then say, guys, we cannot go this route. And I'm seeing things that are coming up. We cannot go this route. And then years later, by the way, ended up being a member. He's a member. So some of my friends as well who were like, we'd have long hours of debates. Some of them are now MMCs that are brought in. MMCs, councillors, members. Some of them are actually now part of the DA's recruitment processes, training people, doing some of these things. Because I said, guys, what? And this is what I want to then do going forward, beyond different party lines, right?
Beyond party politics. Yes.
I want to say to people of South Africa, what does South Africa post this area ANC look like for you? So if I were to ask you, what does South Africa post this era look like? What is the South Africa that you want to then see?
Yes.
Post this era, because this era is going to come to an end. You just need to, there's a book called The 50 Years of Independence, the first 50 years of independence by Martin, I always get the surname mixed up, May, I think. It's called The 50 Years of Independence. Every liberation movement hits a plateau. The start of whether you talk about Frelimo, whether you talk about ZANU-PF,
all of them. Especially African liberation movements.
So they start off well, and they do the same thing. Start off well, wealth kicks in. They then deliver, but get somewhere where then corruption is actually then so high that they then tend to forget the principles that got them there.
Yes.
All of them then afterwards then decline, right? So you know this is going to come. This is going to happen. Look at what happened to ZANU-PF. It was Mugabe 30 years, and then what happens? Look at what happened to Frelimo. Look at what happened to, sadly, look at what happened to a party, Kenneth Kaunda. Yes.
Same.
Sadly. Look at what happened in Namibia, SWAPO. So you can look at these things, right? And you say, that's what happens. But I then said, look, what does South Africa looks like post this era? And are we able to then have people that are able to then see South Africa in the same way,
yes,
post this era? Are we able to then bring all these people together? That's why I was excited when, you know, we were talking about a national dialogue. Mm-hmm. I got excited because I thought that we would have a conversation about South Africa post the ANC. And people saying, yeah, no, the ANC is going nowhere, you're dreaming. I said, no, it's going to happen. I'm not saying the ANC as an organization is going to die, but the ANC in government having a majority is not going to be a reality for very, very long, right? That is going to happen. What does it look like? Are we able to then bring people that are saying, we want to see this working, that working, this, you know, changing and all of that? I would hate for South Africa to fall into the category of another failed African state. I would really hate to see the infrastructure that we still have. I mean, we have potholes and all of that, but I promise you, this is still better than most African countries.
Just by the way, he hit a pothole on his way here.
Yeah, hit a pothole. You owe me. You probably owe me a tire because, you know, my car is now showing a tire fault, you know, as I was driving here. And it's next to another politician's house. I'm not going to name people.
Go Hyde Park.
It's next to a black wall, but we will not name where that house is. But yeah, on that traffic circle, I hit a pothole. What does South Africa look like?
Mm.
What does the economy look like? What are we driving as an economy? So I was in China recently. And the people of China know what is the Silk Plan. Something called the Silk Plan. There's something called the 50-year plan. And they are now on their fifth five-year plan. So they've taken the 50-year plan, they've broken it down into 5 years. So it doesn't matter who's going to be the leader of China as the president. Right?
Yes.
But they know there is a plan. Every Chinese know what is the plan. And they've made sure that when you're talking about a school curriculum, that is inculcated into what they want to then achieve.
Did we not try something like that? Kind of what was it called?
We've had so many. Then now that we have is the National Development Plan.
Before we had the RPP
and we have something, Skiza, GAY and all of that. So we always had these plans, right? But do these plans are things that people know, or they just become a nice to have. I can tell you right now, when Trevor Manuel came to meet with the DA, I was in that room to introduce the NDP. We were excited about it. And he said, yes, finally, something there's a plan that can work. And I promise you, if you go and read the NDP, it talks about a capable state. It talks about an economy that is moving. It talks about Africa, South Africa being the coordinator of so many things that, you know, Africa then, you know, becomes a conduit. Or, you know, we're able to be a conduit for what happens in Africa then to the rest of the world.
Cape to Cairo.
My brother.
Cape to Cairo.
Infrastructure that is working. You know, accountable government. And at that point, it then says by 2030, we should have reached A, B, C, D. I promise you, we are not even 30% in reaching any of those things. And 2030 is what? 4 years from here.
4 years from now, I was about to say, it's now.
So then, you know, this goes to the point that you can have all these plans, but if people don't know about them and people own them and we hold people to it, and we then keep saying, this is the progress we make out of this plan, then I can promise you, you're going to fail. And this is what I found. You know, I don't agree with the philosophy of China. I don't, for a number of reasons. But and I think there's a dilution of it right now. But what I found very interesting is that they say they want to lead when it comes to technology and its and the inventions thereof. Go and walk into a classroom. We were in a place in Xinjiang. In Xinjiang, where. So you have schools that teach kids how to do programming at a preschool, start to do programming, unpacking, undoing a laptop, an iPad. You go into a car manufacturing plant, they are able to assemble a car in 4 hours because they want to then lead in those spaces, right? They have what now they call smart cities. Mm-hmm. They develop technology, they do all of that. That's the economy that they want to drive. A technological economy. That's one of the things that they want to drive. Manufacturing economy. Now, if I were to ask you now, Riduzimo, what are the drivers of the economy in South Africa? What are you gonna say?
None. There's not one that we can. I mean, let's forget about mining.
No, that is a dwindling thing. It's becoming more and more expensive to mine.
Yes.
And it's dying.
Which also, I mean, it speaks to the fact that, I mean, you know, from a beneficiation point of view, when it comes to the issue of mining, we've got this mine. We're sitting with gold mines.
Yeah.
But we're not leaders. We're not beneficiating. We're not leaders in jewelry. We're not creating watches. We're not creating jewelry. We're not creating rings, this, that, and the other. All of our raw materials getting taken overseas and being brought back and sold to us, you know? So, and there's so many other things that we can talk about and we're not doing anything.
Can I tell you, I was in the Eastern Cape last week. The Eastern Cape produces about 30% of South Africa's citrus export. If you go there and ask, why don't we have processing plants in the Eastern Cape that we're able to then go into agriculture on a very serious manner? Why is it that you would get beef that is coming from Botswana coming here and then leave, that we're not processing it? Why is it that you would import so many goods that the raw materials are coming from here, but you import these goods from China? Why are we celebrating? And I'm not saying there should not be Chinese vehicles that are coming into South Africa or vehicles that are coming from wherever coming here. But why are we celebrating that we're now having all these cars, yet we are losing and bleeding thousands of jobs here in the automotive sector? Yes. Nissan is closing down. People are like, now there's a Chery that is going to pick up. I said, yes, they will. But don't be surprised that in a year or two, they're saying they're going full automotive or automation.
Which is exactly what the Chinese do. Yes. That's how
and
technology
then
moves.
The same jobs that you thought that you're saving are gone. I can tell you right now, I was talking to somebody at Ford. Ford that has been here for decades is now scaling down. They are now, the people that used to work 5-6 days a week are now working 3 days a week.
But it's across the board solely because
you look at
even alcohol, right? And I'm
British
and
tobacco, because I'm talking tobacco. To you, is closing down.
Still illicit cigarettes, right?
Still in
the Val. In the Val. Isco, Mittal Steel. Yes.
Is now saying,
that's 3,000 jobs.
What happened to Clover? Go Northwest. So What happened to Consol? Consol used to be the biggest employer about to go to township in Yaka, Quadridgeville.
Yes.
Because it was the biggest glass producer in Africa. ISCO, that it was next to Consol. And you know what it did? It didn't only create jobs, but it created other businesses because people could go buy products there.
Yes.
What we call waste glass, what you'd call waste steel and all of that. People used to be able, Bramati used to make the frame, some of history, and then make glasses as well from that and create other businesses as well. What has happened to that?
I mean, go let's say Val, ISCO, Sasol, all of these become, I mean, Val was Vanderbilt Park. Done as that. It was the hub of steel and technology and everything for Gauteng, right? All of those, most of those places have closed down, which means jobs have been lost in Sharpeville, Bibatong, Sebokeng, all of those areas, they're gone. Valtech used to be the Val University of Technology. Yeah. It's now called Val University
because
of Technology.
Of their because industries.
Exactly. So
you see, this is again, when I say, what does the South Africa of the future look like? We should be able to then say what each and every province look like. What are the characteristics of the province, right? I would say to you, Limpopo still has a good reserve of platinum in it, a good reserve of other minerals that we can get, chrome and all of these things that can come from there. But Limpopo is very good in terms of, you know, agriculture. So your citrus, avocados, mealies, nuts, bananas, and all of that, you're still able to then produce a lot, right? But there are byproducts of that. You can get byproducts from there, from processing that. What are we doing? Are we able to then say, okay, these are areas that we can drive agriculture. Why don't we have institutions that are able to then start teaching people from there? Then your economy is able to then be complemented by a labor force that is skilled, that you're able to then train towards that. What do we want to then see in Gauteng? Gauteng is still the financial hub of South Africa and of Africa to a great extent because of Sandton and Johannesburg and all of that, right? What are we doing to then ensure that you're able to then train people from here, supply, and to be able to then deal with that? Technology and all of that. You go to the Free State. Free State is still a very big beef province, a very big maize province, and other products that come from there.
Grains
and all of that. What are we doing? So I would say reimagine South Africa, breaking it into what each and every province is able to then give you. The Western Cape is able to then give us citrus, is able to then give us
tourism.
To then give us wines and all of that. What are we doing? Break it down and say, this province is, if we look at the strong characters of this province, this is what we get from each and every province. This is what we can then do.
These are the industries we're going to drive.
These are the industries that we're going to drive. You're looking for schools of specializations. We are going to build the schools of specializations in these provinces. But not only are there schools of specializations, but they're able to then directly link and feed these industries that we are building here. KZN, why is KZN... we're dealing with Tongat and all of that. We're dealing with tourism in there, right? But go and tell me how many hotel schools that you have. Look, South Africa for me, I've always said what is wrong with South Africa can be fixed with what is right with South Africa.
Yes.
If we can get the right thinking people around the room, forget politics, forget Kitswako DA, Otswako EFF, Otswako Kai. What is the South Africa that we want to see?
Can we
bring some thoughts together and people that are willing to work to build this thing? And let's do that.
So I want to ask you, with that being said, when you sit quietly in your 46 years, what does success look like for you? You look at your career, you look at your family, when you look at everything that you've spoken about and what you've gone through. When you reimagine not only your career, but your country, what do you see?
So I'll break it into three quickly.
Yes.
Success for me is that my kids have had opportunities that I would have never dreamt I would get. My child has never gone to bed hungry. I've never had to go get water somewhere. Well, now we'll deal with that.
Because
But my kids have had more options than what I had. That for me is success. on a personal level.
Yes.
Success is that I was the first one in my family, my entire family, my family, to get a degree. And not only one, not two, three.
Wow.
Success to me is being able to bring others through my foundation, so many other solis along the way, that there are kids, and I don't publish this because I believe, or you don't do things for media or for that, but you do things because they need to be done. Kids that have been taken to school every year, January, there are kids that get full school uniform, get their books covered, get their backpacks and all of that. There are kids, there are families that would get every 3 months groceries. That for me is success. The ability to be used to do good for others. That for me is success. Success is the ability to be able to then sit around a table with industry leaders, to sit with international big politicians around the room and say, this is how I see South Africa, because I do believe, I do belong to the C40. I've been part of the executive of the C40. I've been part of the executive of so many international organizations that when they say, we want to also hear a voice from South Africa, I would get a call and say, can you come and talk to us about this? That for me is what success looked like. What success look for South Africa look like? And that is a long-term thing. Success for me would be when younger people come around the table and say, how do we then begin to reimagine a South Africa and carve its way forward towards that dream? That is success for me.
Finally, Solly, you've taken up a very, very difficult position to be the federal chairperson of the Democratic Alliance in a South Africa that is changing, in a country that is bubbling under.
Yeah.
People want change.
Yeah.
People want to see a difference. We can no longer lie to them.
Yeah.
Social media is on steroids in terms of us not being able to push the propaganda that we think that we can push because people know the truth from Phofim Vaba all the way right up until Landadno.
Yes.
What does that mean for you, and what difference do you think you can make in all of this mess?
So, as I said to you, my brother, we have to, all of us, reimagine South Africa. I want to be the catalyst for that. It can't be that we're all stuck in our political, ideological box. Yes, I'm a liberal at heart. There might be somebody who is saying, I'm left, I'm right, I'm this, I'm that. People don't need political ideologies. We now need to then sit in a room and say, guys, what is the best way that will take this country forward? The dynamics that we find this country in, the dynamic and the history. We have a history that we can't wish away. We have a history that we cannot then wipe off, right? And we still have the legacy of that history still lingering on, right? And unfortunately, to a degree, those that were entrusted to really take us forward and get us out of this haven't done much. In fact, they keep reminding us, you still stay in Komukukung because... You're still not getting, or now you used to have electricity, now you're not getting electricity, or you're not getting water because. What we now need to then do is, how do we then take it forward? And that's the conversation that I'm hoping that this platform allows me to use authority, or to have authority to be able to then converse with. As I said, there's a point where we're going to have to even reimagine political parties. Yes. I do believe. Because they have to then, you know, change. I've been in this party for long. I've seen it grow from a 1.5% party to, you know, growing and in 2016 hitting a high and then regressing in 2019 and then coming up again in 2024. So I can tell you, I've seen the growth and I've seen the changes and I've seen it morph, you know, in terms of the size and all of that. I have to then say, how do we then take it to the next level? The next level might be that we might need to even reimagine the party, rebranding the party again, or you know, calling South Africans that care about a South Africa that works. Whether you're Afrikaans, whether you're Xhosa, whether you're Mupedi, whether you are English, whether you are Christian, whether you are Muslim, you are this. The easiest way in politics, world over, is to do politics of dividing. am telling people, I am this, I'm black, therefore I must follow this particular party. I am a Christian, therefore I must follow this, or Muslim, then I must follow. It's the easiest politics. The most difficult politics is where you're able to then say, but what is the common purpose? What should be that which will drive us forward? Are we able to coalesce around that? I was hoping that at some point, all political parties can get into a room and say, let's identify five things. Five things that we will want to then achieve in the next 5 years.
Five things that we all agree on.
Thank
you.
All of us. Mm-hmm. We can, these other things we will do, and, you know, they can have varying, successes. It's okay. But these things, five things cannot be compromised. Can we then say, for the next 5 years, there should never be a hospital in South Africa that doesn't have enough beds? There should never be a hospital that you go in that you still have to go fill in a form and have a paper, yes. File. There should never be a hospital where there is not less than X amount of doctors. There should never be a hospital where the nurses are not on duty. There should never be a hospital where you go in there's no linen. That becomes then a standard. Then you say, we agree on these things, right? That is done. And we can agree on the modalities. That is one. Can we agree what should education look like in South Africa? Can we agree what safety should look like in South Africa? Right? I promise you, you'll start taking care of the basics. Everything else takes care of itself. Investors say, these guys, I can see something happening here. Yeah. I can go and invest there. And then you see jobs being created and all of that. So I'm hoping that at some point, politicians can come in a room and sit down and say, we have our differences, but can we agree on these things? And if we agree on them, it doesn't matter whether it's the DA in government or the ANC in government or this in government. We agreed on these five things and we're all going to rally behind these things. We're going to report every year. Even when you have State of the Nation address, State of the Province address, the first five things that you report on is these five. We said the year one will have this belt. Year two will have this done. Year three will have the first graduates that are coming to then take over this thing. Year four, we're going to have this thing happening. Year five, we're going to then assess whether we have succeeded. Do we then carry on with the program? Do we start something else? If we can then do that, people know what it is that you said you're going to do, can track the progress of you doing that thing, can hold you to account for it because they know what you are all about.
So, Mr. Manga, thank you so much. I think we could have had this interview go on for the next 2 hours, but it's been an absolute pleasure and an honor. And I want to wish you the best of luck in your endeavors and in your future. It's a difficult task. It's a difficult, difficult robe to wear, trying to take a country somewhere. Yep. I mean, you know, you've got an entire country behind you that you want to lead somewhere. But for me, on Be Frank with Mac, it's been an absolute pleasure and an honor.
Thank you very much, my brother.